But
what have we got to say?
I don't know about you, Ed, but I thoroughly enjoyed Manchester United 4, Istanbul Başakşehir 1.
Yeah.
You were confident before the game. You were like, I think we're going to win 3-0. I was unable to access that confidence, but you were entirely correct here.
As I normally am. close, anyway. Well, look, Ollie has a 57% win rate or something like that. So, you know, I'm at least 57% correct because I predict a win 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Or close to it, rounding up. Look, this was, for the first half, a really excellent performance. Bit flat in the second half. You know, there was a little mini wobble, wasn't it, after they scored and had some pressure for 10 minutes or so. But at no point were United really at risk of blowing it. It felt like it. I mean, I don't know. My internal panic button went off once Turic scored.
And then they hit the bar, didn't they, after that? Like with
they
the
hit
long
the
ranger.
Bar and it looked like they were putting us under pressure. But obviously, you know, Daniel James's goal wrapped it up. But look, for 45 minutes, really excellent performance from United. You know, it was creative. There were some nice goals. The standard pen, you know, every week. As you noted on Twitter, people should stop fouling us. So, yeah, it was thoroughly enjoyable. This is the Manchester United we want. And that doesn't come out nearly often enough. And I can't explain the inconsistency, but it's bloody frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the one really nice thing about this, after West Brom, where, you know, everyone was very upset, I think probably rightly so, about the not the formation so much as the selection, in terms of the players and how much...
The double pivot in midfield especially.
Yeah, so he went from playing 6 defenders against West Brom to playing 3 defenders. Because I'm not sure you can really call Alex Telles a defender, per se. I certainly don't think that's what he's primarily in the team to do. And yeah, playing 7 forwards turns out makes us really fun. I mean, I know it's the most obvious point in the world, and I'm sure everybody that's listening to this show that doesn't come out till Friday after a win on Tuesday has probably heard a fairly substantial amount of discourse around this subject. But this game really hinges on Van der Beek playing in midfield. Now, I want to be extremely clear here that what I'm not saying is future United consistency hinges on Van der Beek playing in midfield, because it's nowhere near that simple. But in this game, the reason Bruno got two goals from open play for Bruno Fernandes was because he was able to break ahead of the ball and do third man runs.
Yeah.
Because Van der Beek was playing forward passes. He didn't have to be the one doing all the creating.
No, that's right. Look, we've been searching for balance in midfield for so long. And I guess Solskjaer started the season hoping that Pogba would provide it. I still think there's an awful lot of mitigation with Pogba's performances this season. I know that's not a popular opinion, because the prevailing opinion, at least in Twitter sphere, is to bash on him. But I think his lack of fitness and the COVID really hit him hard. And Solskjaer has said that, so I think we can believe the manager when he says that. So there's still room for Pogba to come back into the team and provide that balance. And the balance is, we need someone who is strong defensively and then someone who can do the sort of box-to-box number 8 bit in midfield. And Van der Beek did that very well against Bezakshia, because, you know, one, they weren't attacking that much, and it allowed the link between midfield and Bruno playing in between the lines to work really well. Also, should say that Cavani up front, although he didn't score in this game, provides a sort of point of the spear as a number 9, in the way that Martial doesn't quite, because Martial comes deeper a lot more, right? So Cavani's running the channels and playing as a number 9, which is, I'm not saying, I definitely, in the same way that you weren't saying that Van der Beek's performance means much for the future necessarily, I'm not saying that Cavani needs to be in the team every week, and I'm pretty sure at his age he definitely shouldn't be, and there'll be a trade-off if that happens, in that you're then going to ask Martial and Rashford to job share, probably. I mean, Rashford played on the right in this game, but it's not where he wants to be because he can't shoot from that position as much. And Martial, I think he's got a future as a number 9, but there's options, right? This showed there's options. Cavani can play in some of these games, that we have enough in the squad to be flexible. Now, I think we'd be even better with someone who was good on the right, you know, and is an attacking outlet on the right. And that's why they wanted Sancho in the team, you know, and I can completely 100% see that. But we have hints with this game of what the future could look like if Ollie can get the balance of the team right. We would be amazing, right? Amazing if we had a really good defensive midfielder. It would change the balance of the team hugely because Freddie's not that, McTominay is not that, and Matic's legs have gone, right? So if we had someone who was N'Golo Kante from 4 or 5 years ago in this team right now,
or N'Golo Kante,
it would be transformational.
Oh, N'Golo Kante now, right now, because he's flying this season.
That's true. It would be transformational for this team in the way that Bruno was, right?
Yeah.
Because it would make the balance between defence and attack.
So,
but we're searching for that, but there are hints.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was going to say, similar to what you said about Cavani, I thought, well, Bruno is obviously man of the match, and I think we should talk a little bit about Bruno's performance in specific terms. But I thought in specific terms, Cavani was magnificent in this game, like really exciting and reminded me of that feeling at the end of the transfer window of like at first being kind of horrified that we were making that signing in terms of what it represented about what a disastrous transfer window it was in terms of the stuff we talked about as ad nauseum. And then suddenly getting hit by a wave of, oh, wait a minute, now Edinson Cavani plays for Man United. And like he was really, I mean, if we can get 25 performances like that out of him this season, that is absolutely massive, because I totally agree with you about his age, and he did have an injury hit season last season, but my God, he just did not stop running from start to finish in that game. Like, he must be an absolute terror for defenders. Some of the specific moments I noted, well, both of them just twice brilliant dummies to allow the ball to go out to the right. One of them went to Williams, I can't remember, I think maybe the other one went to Rashford, but I can't remember for sure. Or Greenwood it was. And he just looked like a massive pain, and he looked like he created a bunch of space. And I wonder whether that's the other reason why Bruno was able to thrive, you know, because Bruno's first goal was he found a pocket of space around the edge of the area, and his second goal he had space in the 6-yard box, although definitely not to do with United's constructive attacking play that happened. But I do wonder whether Cavani did create a big problem, which then Martial, Rashford, Fernandes can all exploit.
I mean, look, I think that's correct. I think you will. I mean, he's more of a classic number nine than we tend to get in football these days, isn't he? You know, he's a little bit of a throwback. But he runs the channels brilliantly. His movement is really good. He cannot do that for 50 games a season.
No.
Not at his age, not coming into... And I don't think anyone expects him to do that. But, you know, there will be, of course, you know, amongst fandom, oh, good performance, he must be in the team every week, you know. And I'm just hoping Ollie is able to use his resources sensibly. It's one of the weakest areas of his management in the 2 years that he's been at the club. I don't think he's used the resources well. He's burnt some players out. Because he doesn't trust others. You know, not everyone has thrived under him. But we'll see. It's going to be a massive test. We talked about it on the last pod, didn't we, about resource management in a season where basically it's Saturday, Wednesday, or Saturday, Tuesday, or Sunday, Wednesday, whatever it is, every week for the season. And if it's not, it's players going off on international duty and flying thousands of miles around the world and getting jet lag and all that comes with that. So anyway, big test for Ollie, big test for some of the players. But we've got, you know, some hints of something positive for the future. Tellez again showing that he can provide a real attacking outlet down the left in the way that Shaw doesn't. Now, Tellez hasn't been tested defensively yet. We'll see in reports from Portugal where that wasn't his strongest point.
When you said Alex Tellez hasn't been tested, I was like, listen, if anyone's been tested, that guy's been tested over and over. He's about 40 COVID tests a week at the moment, that guy.
He's had the probe up his nose a few times. But believe me, I've been on the, I don't think I've said on the pod, but I'm part of the one of the phase three trials. I volunteered to get, you know, stuck. I didn't realise quite how many pinholes they were going to stick in me as part of this testing. It's a lot.
Oh, my God.
But also COVID testing. And let me tell you, it is, it's quite unpleasant.
Yeah, look.
Whether you do it yourself or someone else does it for you. I feel for these guys because they're getting tested every day.
Yeah.
It's not the nicest thing.
The thing I also think we have to set all the context of this conversation about this game, particularly as it pertains to the future, is before the last game against them, you said, look, these guys are just not very good. And they kind of surprised United in a way, but really United just handed them the keys to the city and said, here you go, do with us what you will. This game showed, listen, they are just not much cop. And it was very nice that, especially given what happened in Istanbul, that Solskjaer, because you just rightly pointed out one of his weaknesses, it was nice to see him just be like, do you know what? Let's just go for it. Cavani, Rashford, Martial front three. Bruno and Van der Beek in the team. Tellers on the left. Like, this was party time.
Sexy stuff.
I had such a long day on Tuesday and I was absolutely dreading watching Man United. When I saw the team sheet, I could not believe my luck. I was like, oh my God, this might actually be fun. And then it turned out it was. I mean, you mentioned right at the top of the show that the second half performance dropped off. At every 3-0 second half performance in football history, most teams have dropped off after. I mean, apart from Ajax against VVV Venlo the other week. But generally speaking, yes, teams drop off in the second half. And the one of the lovely things about it was in the second half, when he started making substitutions, he made the team even more attacking. We played 4-2-4, literally.
4-2-4,
no exaggeration,
by the end, yeah.
4-2-4 at the end of that game. 3-0 up in Europe, like, or 3-1 up, I guess. Good times.
Yes, it was a bit of a throwback, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, that's the crazy thing about this season or the time under Solskjaer. You know, we do get these attacking performances from time to time. The best performances have been where United sit back and play on the break, using the pace of Rashford and Martial in particular, and Bruno's risk-taking because no one else in the team does. A friend of the show, Karl Anka, wrote a piece for The Athletic this week about United not taking enough risks as a team, and that's why we sometimes get these blunt performances. And I agreed with his analysis there. I think it is a problem, but it's balance, you know, and we haven't quite got that. And of course, the best teams do have that balance, and we're hopefully transitioning towards that. That's the optimistic view.
Mm.
You know, it's going to take some more investment in the transfer market, and that is not going to come this January. And it may not come next summer, given the financial results. We didn't talk about the Q1 financial results. Q1?
Oh, have they come out?
Yeah, they came out straight away. I mean, they didn't have a call because they're only 3 weeks after the full FY20 results. And it shows the same picture, right? So I won't get into a long piece. We had that a couple of weeks ago. But it doesn't look very very rosy for United at the moment. It's going to be a £150 million loss at least, I think, from COVID, and depending on when we can get fans back into the stadium, you know, it's a big loss. And so that will impact United's future planning. It will impact our thoughts about Sancho, who, by the way, scored an absolute blinder for Dortmund this week. You see his free kick, top corner. He's had a difficult season, but his numbers are elite. I mean, if United can find money for a defensive midfielder and Sancho on the right, it will make a big difference.
Bruno Fernandes scored an absolute pinger to open the scoring this game. I mean, that stayed hit. What is better than an absolutely archetypical half volley?
Oh, absolutely, it was sweet.
Yeah, just the exact.
Take that, you thunder bastard! Stay hit.
Exactly the amount of the right, like, you know, the ball rises all the way through, but at this kind of like perfectly rocket-like trajectory that it looks like the ball's being kind of self-propelled, and it's got this perfect kind of flatness to its rise. Just a very aesthetically pleasing goal. And
yes, exactly. And just a little bit of fade away from the keeper.
Perfect.
Bang in the top corner. I mean, you said in the WhatsApp group that you'd had a, you know, really hard day on Tuesday, and if it had been a boring game, that would have finished you off. Well, I'll tell you what, this finished me off. It was, that's good stuff.
The second goal, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. I mean, it's a great cross from Tellers, and well, it's a very good cross from Tellers. It's putting the ball into the danger area, and the keeper clearly felt the pressure and just flapped at it, didn't he? It was, you know,
horrible.
You hate to see it, But you love to see Bruno stepping up and smashing it home from close range. But, you know, like, sincerely, that's two third-man runs from Bruno leading to goals. One classic midfielder third-man run to the edge of the area, wallop, top corner, and then the other being right, like, ahead of the penalty spot in the six-yard area, ready to snaffle up a mistake. And
perfect. I mean, along with his risk-taking, which we've talked about a lot.
71% pass completion in this game.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, it's okay near the box.
Yeah, of course.
It's okay to take those risks. It's going to create goals, and he's created a lot of goals and scored a lot of goals. His numbers are amazing. 4 assists, XG chain, and goals.
Yeah.
They're awesome. Yeah. Pass completion rate, you know, that's going to cause some problems, you know. I'd hate to see him give away the ball on the halfway line in, say, Champions League final or something like that.
But of course, if we have any chance of getting to a Champions League final, it's mostly going to be because of him. He didn't get a hat-trick, though, because he very generously gave Rashford the penalty out of the goodness of his own heart.
Look, Sir Rashford, I think we're going to have to cancel that, sir. You know, he may give to the poor, but he's taking from the rich. He stole from Bruno.
The thing about this is there was a lot made of, oh, he's giving it to Rashford because Rashford needs a goal. Rashford is the top scorer in the Champions League this season, averaging something like 1.8 goals a game in the Champions League. So I think he's all right on that front. I think this was because he's missed two penalties and got them back after, you know, scored after retakes. The look on his face, he wasn't giving that ball away out of the generosity of his heart. That was like, no, Rashford's on pens now, Bruno. Sorry, pal.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, he had such a good record, didn't he? But yes, yeah, two out of the last three saved, and then saved by VAR.
Yeah.
So, look, it doesn't matter, whatever. As long as they're not fighting over it and it's not causing some kind of problem in the dressing room, who cares, you know? Rashford's a good penalty taker. I didn't like the run-up. I mean, it was a bit, you know, it was a little bit quick step, wasn't it? But it slid it home, and it wouldn't have looked good if the keeper had gone the right way.
No, absolutely not. So. But, you know, Marcus Rashford can only look good. A couple of small things I wanted to say. Like, I know we talk about this all the time, but I talk about it all the time. Bruno, on the official United podcast 2 weeks ago, just some absolutely classic football nerd chat. Like, that guy really loves football so much. And then so does this week's guest, which was Wayne Rooney, which is if you haven't listened to that yet and you like Man United content, you are out of your mind, because that...
No, it's great stuff. It's great stuff.
It's a joyous hour of listening to Rooney be completely relaxed, open. You know, I believed every word that came out of his mouth, because he was perfectly prepared to say, like, things that he knew the United audience wouldn't like. But I do think the more that this goes on, the more abundantly clear it is that the 12-13 transfer request was just Fergie's revenge is a dish best served cold. Like, he just wanted to stick one on Wayne as he was walking out the door because of what had happened in 2010.
Yes. No, I mean, I can fully believe that Fergie has a deep, deep Machiavellian side to him. Yeah. So no doubt about it. No, it's great content. It continues to be a really good podcast. It's interesting because most Manchester United content is pretty asinine, isn't it? And then, you know, there's a lot of honest conversations in these pods. I mean, it's rah-rah United, of course. You'd expect that. But, you know, some really good conversations. Sam Homewood, friend of the show, does an awesome job hosting that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And the people behind the scenes have... You can tell that they've put a lot of work in to make it authentic. Like, it's small stuff like leaving in little bits where the Zoom call goes wrong and things like that. You know, there's something very real about that content for an official club channel. And I think given how much stick, absolutely correctly, the club get for their kind of relentless Pravda slick exterior, it is really interesting that they've got this one outlet that's by far the best thing they've ever produced as a club in terms of media of any kind, you know.
Yes, I think if we got a Roy Keane too, I still think they'd cut that.
They talk almost every week about that show, about wanting Roy Keane on and being too scared to ask him. So,
No, I don't literally mean Roy Keane. I mean, if Harry Maguire went on the show and said, look, we hate each other and honestly, we don't really rate the manager that much. I think that would be cut really, really quickly. Quick chat about the end of the game. There's a free kick that went in. I saw some criticism of Dave on the internet. I have to say, I didn't agree with it. I'm summarizing from quite a few people here that he should have gone forward to the ball, but I think he may have been beaten for speed if he'd done that. So, you know, I think basically he's been beaten with that one and he just didn't get it in time. But your thoughts on the free kick?
I mean, it looked fine to me. Like, it looked like it didn't look like a howler or anything.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
That's sorted. Everyone else is wrong. So I think that's it for Istanbul. Yeah. Should we take a quick break and we'll talk about Diego Maradona and Southampton?
Yeah, just one tiny, tiny thing on Istanbul. Just, a few wobbles in the second half, but my God, if we're going to err on the side of one thing or another, I want us to err on the side of fun. And I also think it's like, not just because that's my own existential relationship with Man United is so like frustrated at the moment, but all our best players are attacking players. So why are we trying to compensate? I mean, I know the 6-1 clearly rattled Ollie, but we are way better. We are at our best when we are fun. That is not just in terms of the entertainment spectacle, but just also in terms of results. So it's a win-win, that is.
Yeah. All right, quick break and then we'll be back.
If you want more from the show in between shows, check us out on the socials. We are NQATpod on Instagram, Ed's at NQATpod on Twitter, and we are under our real names on Facebook at No Question About That.
So a quick note. This is an interview with Jamie Jackson. We recorded it a little while ago and it took me a while to fix some of the problems with the audio. But here you go, my interview with Jamie Jackson. So I'm here with Jamie Jackson, the Guardian journalist and author of a new book on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer called The Red Apprentice. It's about his time at Manchester United and a biography of his life. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Hello, hello, hello. Thank you.
How are you today, Jamie?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good. We're recording this just before the Arsenal game, so we've got another month of lockdown to look forward to, haven't we?
See, I, as a writer, I'm quite a hermit anyway. And I'm just going to politely, slightly, not correct you, but just maybe adjust what you're saying. It's actually a biography of Solskjaer. So while obviously a massive part of his life story is United as player and manager, it does tell the story of his life and when basically he was born.
Great. So that was going to be my first question. Tell me about the premise of the book. You said it's a biography of Solskjaer. So I guess the time period is his life story. Jamie, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, as I just mentioned, it's basically a biography. And actually, there hasn't been there wasn't beforehand a definitive, exhaustive, you know, thorough, however you want to describe it, biography. There's been some books on him, as you'd probably expect. But so that's one reason why I was interested in doing it. I think also if you're writing, it's a biography, as I say, but if you're writing a story about an incumbent, a current Manchester United manager, you're going to have lots to go at as a writer because it's a bit of a soap opera. I've done one previous book on United, which is called A Season in the Red, which was post-Ferguson. So it took in Moyes, Van Gaal and sort of Mourinho's arrival on Van Gaal's sacking. And, you know, that was a bit of a roller coaster. So I knew there'd be plenty to go at. But actually Solskjaer himself, as a person, a man has had quite is having a very interesting life and sporting career. And, you know, I love reading biographies and I've never written one before. So, you know, it was just enjoyable thing to sort of take a year and a half to tackle, really.
So we're recording this the day after United lost to Arsenal. And I guess it kind of feels like a summary of Ollie's time at Manchester United, at least as manager. Glorious victories followed by ignominious defeats. So, what are your thoughts on, I think you call it the soap opera at Manchester United these days?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think you coined it completely perfectly. I mean, the game when they sort of you know, gave Leipzig a bit of a walloping, really. I was at that game. That was Wednesday night. That was the night before the book came out. So you couldn't really ask for a better sort of, if you like, pre-launch sort of result. Probably, well, no, not probably, one of the results of his tenure. But then, you know, the game yesterday, Arsenal, I was at that one as well. And they were very tepid. And yeah, that's kind of been the story of his... I mean, he has taken them forward. I don't think you can really argue with third place. Last season has taken them forward, but it's all about this season now, of course. And if you look at that league table, the one slight thing that's, you know, if you're looking, I mean, I'm not a Manchester United fan, but as someone who reports them, if you're looking for a sort of glimmer of light, apart from the actual players he's got, they have got a game in hand along with City, because obviously they started a week later. So there's a slight sort of, I don't know what you call that, plus there maybe. But they have to start winning soon, really, in the league. It's a shame, really, because even if they just won one of the ones that they've lost, which is three, that you know, they've been double figures, I believe. And with that game in hand, you could say, well, they're still in the title race. I'm not saying they're out of it, but you understand what I mean. It looks like it could be a topsy-turvy season, or I don't know, maybe it'll start to sort itself out with City. You know, if they could beat Liverpool on Sunday, isn't it? Yes, you know, they'd go within 3 points. But, you know, it's been a little bit of a shame, really, from their point of view.
Okay, to start from the beginning then, Ollie, you're covering Ollie's lifespan. So let's talk a little bit about whether this was something that was inevitable for United. Was he always going to become United manager? It seems a long shot. Was this something he dreamed about? I'm guessing that you've got to know him pretty well over the last 18 months or so.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think the answer to that is yes and no, in that, yeah... You know, he has always been a smart cookie. As a kid, he was a smart 10-year-old, analytical 9-10-year-old as a sort of, you know, young footballer, wanting to, always keen to learn, even at that age. Understood a lot about sort of elite sport, if you want to call it that way, because of his dad being an elite sportsman, Greco-Roman wrestler. And so even though, you know, he didn't set out when he sort of even joined United to be United manager, he's got the sort of personality or character which has the ability to always seem to better himself and sort of, you know, the goal, you could say the goal's a fluke. I'm not so sure, really. The Champions League in 99, he's a sort of, you know, he imagined he would do that. He could do that. He wanted to get on and the pitch that day, you know, to do it that night. Sorry. And you know, he got a very bad injury. Obviously, and it cost him the last 3 or 4 years of his career at United. So we're talking when he was about 29, 30-ish, basically 2003. And that's when it dawned on him, wait a minute, because before that he didn't want to, or thought he didn't want to go into management, but that's when it dawned on him that, wait a minute, you know, if this is the end of my playing career, I don't want to leave football, you know, either like this or at all. And so he, having already taken sort of a lot of notice of what Ferguson was doing, you know, he really began to, and, you know, Ferguson recognised it in him as well, that he was smart enough and, you know, the potential to sort of maybe, not necessarily manage Manchester United, but, you know, he gave him a role of coaching the forwards at first. And then he was obviously reserve team co-manager Warren Joyce. They won the title 09-10 with a sort of Paul Pogba was in that side. You're obviously a very young Paul Pogba, 10 years ago now it would be. So he's got an interesting personality in that way. He's a smart cookie and he's very driven, and he also understands himself, which allows him to understand people. And when you start to think about that, that's kind of a massive attribute or skill you need to be a manager, right? You know, to be able to manage your players, understand they're all different, that kind of man management element.
I think it's true that Ollie always thought deeply about the game. I mean, he said that before he sat on the bench and was able to study and analyse what was going on. But I guess the question now is what is the ceiling for Ollie? How far can he go? Because one of the obvious things, I think, from watching United at the moment is Ollie's learning on the job, which is unusual when you take one of the really big jobs. Where do you think Ollie goes from here?
There's all sorts of ways of answering that question. So, for example, Ferguson took 4 years to win the first trophy and 7 to win the first, you know, league title at United. 7 years. And that's the great Sir Alex Ferguson. So I don't know whether you'd argue that Solskjaer had a better or worse job ahead of him, you know, when he came into United than Ferguson. But all I'm saying is that's the very best we've ever had, I'd argue, in Ferguson. And I'm not saying at all he's going to get 4 or 7 years. But I don't think you're really going to know unless he gets more time. Now, I'm not a fan of Manchester United. I understand if you are, it could be hair-tearingly frustrating to see. You know, you could beat Leipzig and then do that against Arsenal. You know, and how soon is now kind of thing with regard to how much time does he need. But I don't know. You know, Moyes would probably have done better if he'd got more time. But did he deserve it at the time? Probably not. This is for me, he's always the fascination of sport. So, I think if he can somehow continue in the job, you know, last season was all about, for me, you know, when you came to that December period right at the start, and you had Spurs on the Wednesday, I think it was, and Manchester City on the Saturday. I don't even remember the two games, but yeah, he was in a lot of trouble then. Yeah, and it was like, you looked at those two games, you thought, there's no way, he needs to win these two, there's no way that's going to happen, surely not. Mason Greenwood started against Spurs, and you won that game, and then you beat City, and he got out of it, and he bought more time. He needs to buy more time, really. He needs to do something about Pogba, I suggest. I mean, you know, I go up and down around the houses with Paul Pogba as a reporter. You know, I can obviously see how brilliant he can be and is, but then other times he's just to the detriment of the side, and I think Solskjaer's probably the same. I mean, you know, yesterday he gives away that penalty. It's not the first time he's done something a little bit errant. And then somehow he's not taken off when he, you know, he brings on Cavani. And I think, who else was it? I can't remember. But I don't know. Things like that, you think, well, you know, how long are you going to give him? Because it's costing you points and possibly, you know, your future as the manager. But I do think he's got a chance. I think he's got a very good chance of winning a title. But, you know, other people would say that's absolute hokum, etc., etc. The interesting thing, or one of the interesting parts of this debate, is, you know, the school of thought says get Pochettino, but it's interesting, really, because Pochettino's actually won nothing ever as a manager. And I'm not saying, that doesn't mean to say he can't, but, you know, Solskjaer has won stuff. He won consecutive titles in Norway, then the Norwegian Cup the following year. And he knows the club, and I just, you know, I don't know, really. I'm not so sure. It always puzzles me why Pochettino would necessarily be better or worse, but, you know.
Or indeed, perhaps, why Poch would come at all, given the other stuff that surrounds the club.
Well, exactly. There you go, you see.
What do you think Oli was signed up on a permanent contract? I mean, he won a large amount of games as temporary manager, didn't he? And he was going to be temporary manager until the end of the season and then was given the full-time contract. Was that just the emotion of the moment?
Yeah, I think the PSG result, you know, obviously kind of sealed it. I'm also sure it's a very good question why they did it right then. Woodward thought it would obviously help the team's progression. You know, this is our guy, some stability. I know you've been performing for him so far, and this to a certain extent is your reward, because compared to... it may be difficult to remember exactly the sort of depth of discontent at the club under Mourinho at that point when he came in, you know, as a caretaker that December. I mean, it wasn't a happy place at all. And I think the way in which he just sort of revolutionised it, you know, and it was over a number of months, and then you had the PSG thing, you know, winning there, and the way it happened with Rashford, it almost seemed, you know, Ferguson was obviously at that game, and, you know, it sort of, I think Cantona was there, and I don't know really. At that moment, I don't think many people argued with the appointment at that time. Why not? Was certainly a prevailing sentiment. And it was interesting because that's kind of around that time when I signed the deal to do the book, for the same sort of reason, really. You know, because it was going so well, what a great story this is going to be, Ed. You know, this kind of favourite son comes back and not rescues the club, but you understand what I mean, turns it around and, you know, revitalises it. And then, of course, from there, from when he signs the contract... As I think maybe, you know, why you're asking it or why you're wondering, you know, it goes all downhill. I mean, it has been an unbelievable roller coaster for him. And you look at him, and it was interesting after the game yesterday, he obviously came out to speak to us. And I'm thinking he must have absolutely gone to town to them in the change room. Now, I don't know if he did. I don't know that for a fact. It's just an opinion. I'd be surprised if he didn't. But before us, he was very, very sort of calm and... Upbeat is not quite the right word, because he was gutted, obviously, if I can use that word. But, you know, he was still this sort of breezy self. But I actually think that's one of his pluses, that he, you know, he's very good at not, you know, I know he was frustrated about not getting Sancho, for example. But you know, he's never, ever really hinted at that in public. And I think that's quite clever. So, you know, the players really love him. And there's a lot to be said for that because, you know, you got hammered 6-1. You don't need me to remind you, Spurs, I was at that game. And then you've responded with those sort of 3 or 4 games. So that sort of showed how much they think of him, I'd say. I mean, that's another thing that's always interests me. It's like, you know, professional players getting paid, I don't know, 100K, 150K a week. They darn well should be running through brick walls, shouldn't they? Whoever the manager is. But that's not exactly, that's in the real world, that's not how it works, of course. You do have to have that relationship. And I think he has that. And I think Ferguson had that. And Moyes certainly never. Van Gaal was well liked all around the club, but he was just a little bit, I don't know, maybe past his peak. And obviously Mourinho's Mourinho. So, you know, it is an interesting juncture. The thing with United is, you don't need me to tell you, it's a complete soap opera, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Every match is a sort of a defining moment with regard to the manager and the club. So, you know, here we are again, sort of. It's not quite as fervent because you had done really well, but, you know, that happens and people ask me, oh, do you think he's going to be sacked? And it's like, well, no, I don't think so, but I can understand why you're asking because it's sort of Manchester United, everything's magnified, which is part of the allure, isn't it? The glamour of the club, really. That's, you know, it's because it's such a massive entity.
I think I'm right in saying that was Ollie's 100th game as manager against Arsenal, which is a sort of defining point, good point to look back. But thinking forward, do we have a sense where the club think they're going? I mean, they've flip-flopped on so many managers, different styles and different approaches. Is Ollie in it for the long term?
Again, I think you're correct. I mean, you know, the last time I asked seriously was after that 6-1 defeat, as you can probably imagine. And, you know, there was a complete, he's not going anywhere, no way at all. And then, you know, a couple of days later, there was sort of a lot of noise, or usual noise really, about Pochettino and that was almost scoffed at. Sort of, I think a fair way to represent the way in which it was spoken to me about Pochettino was, why would we even think of that, you know, because basically how much they've invested in Ollie. But you're right, when you say flip-flop there, it is interesting. I mean, you know, football, I think the thing with football is, you know, someone could tell you that at the club who obviously knows what's going on, but, you know, the next day, that could have changed and it wasn't that you'd been lied to, it's just changed because that's football a little bit. But I mean, you know, it's always an interesting one with Solskjaer because a lot of people think that he's got a chance. A lot of people think he hasn't. And, you know, he probably doesn't know. He probably backs himself, but it's all unfolding before him. It's not like, you know, Ferguson sort of 4 or 5 years into winning the title, kind of, you know, he got those titles behind him. The club was really his. He was so powerful and so sort of on top of his game. As you just said then, I mean, it's one of the reasons why the book is called that, The Red Apprentice, because, you know, he's learning on the job. I mean, I would suggest anyone going into United is kind of learning on the job how to be the manager of Manchester United, because it's not like any other job. But I obviously take the point that Van Gaal and Mourinho have been in super clubs before, so they know, you know, they've got that sort of experience. And a lot of people say to me, why have Manchester United got a sort of, yeah, a figure like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer who wouldn't be there if he wasn't Ole Gunnar Solskjaer? But that's kind of half the point, really, because of his history and what he's done there. And he's not intimidated at all by the place. I always go back to his very first press conference where he just walked in and he was sort of so at home. And I was quite impressed by that. I was surprised, really, because Van Gaal, Moyes and Mourinho a little bit slightly taken, you know, as you'd imagine, need a little bit of time to acclimatise to it. But he doesn't have any inferiority complex himself. Whereas a lot of people think he's not up to it. He certainly hasn't got any of those issues. He understands as well the criticism. He probably can, be an intelligent man, can probably relate to, you know, to why people think question why he's there. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the direction of the club, I would suggest that, and listen, I could be wrong here, but I'm only going on kind of what I'm told. You know, I would suggest that he's, you know, unless he starts to stink the place out, losing 4 or 5 nil next 3 games, he's relatively safe. But, you know, who have you got at the weekend? It's Everton.
Yeah, it's Everton at the weekend. And who knows which way that one will go. James is missing, I think, which is a bonus for United. But they had a good start to the season, Everton. So this is likely to be a tough game. And I think that's the problem as fans. We don't know which United will turn up. Some amazing victories and some really ridiculous losses and inconsistency from the manager in terms of his approach. And so that's where some of the frustration comes from, I think.
I mean, what do you think? Do you want him there?
Look, Ollie's got loads of credit in the bank for what he's done for United. And I think there's a lot of patience amongst the fan base as a result of that. Maybe not on Twitter, but amongst fans. Everyone wants him to succeed. But one of the frustrations, I think, is that he hasn't, although players have progressed under him, clearly, Rashford, Martial, he hasn't got more than the sum of the parts out of this squad. He's got talent there. There are holes, of course. He hasn't been supplied with the players that will fix all those holes. And we know the reason why that's the case. I mean, in the summer, you know, we've got what looks like another number 10. We now have Pogba, Fernandes, Van de Beek and Massa, who all want to play there. Just a reflection of the lack of balance in the squad. So he's not working with the best tools, but he's got lots of credit. He just needs to find that consistency.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, I'd agree with that. I mean, last season, third was probably the best you could have expected. But now, I don't know. If you're going to be third again, you need to be third, sort of, I think, within touching distance. Maybe even actually in it properly, you know, challenging until the last, whatever, 2 or 3 weeks, maybe. It could still happen. This season's, you know, it's a bit of a cliche to say, but it is, for the right reason, it is a little bit topsy-turvy because of the compressed nature and where we are, you know, with the wider world, etc. But, you know, when you see it click against Leipzig and also PSG, which is, you know, a masterful performance, really, that's mm-hmm. when you see the sort of Chelsea won the draw and the Arsenal one, you think, oh, what is going on here? It's baffling. You know, I see that. I'm lucky enough to see them every time they play at home, basically. You know, and I've done for years since sort of Ferguson was still at United. And this is what you're seeing here has basically been the story of United since Ferguson left, isn't it? You know, it's sort of just one step forward and kind of three quarters of one back, maybe. You know what I mean?
Great. Well, the book is called The Red Apprentice. It's in all good bookstores, as they say. I guess it'll have to be online for the moment. Well, best of luck with the launch of the book, Jamie. Thank you very much for joining us. And we'll have you on for your next book in the future. And let's see how this season goes. It looks like there'll be a few ups and downs.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, take it easy. Take it easy.
Alrighty.
Yeah, I mean, this country is rubbish.
So we can talk about the coverage of Diego Maradona passing.
It's heartbreaking. Like, it's heartbreaking. You know, there was a funny tweet that was doing the rounds after the election where some Ayrshire local paper wrote, Ayrshire golf club owner loses election, which is right. Good. It's a funny local news headline. But genuinely, the English tabloid press are doing that with absolutely no irony or sense of humour.
Oh, God, no.
And making Diego...
The Mirror, The Star, The Sun and The Express, disgusting headlines.
I mean,
disgusting.
At least the Mirror's headline was like, he's at the hand of God now kind of thing, which is quite, you know, that's...
Reasonably funny, but it's just the kind of little Englander response of, that's the only thing we can think about, you know, if not the greatest, one of the greatest... footballers, sports people that has ever existed, a cultural icon beyond any.
Yeah.
Beyond any. Except for, you know, Jordan and a few others. Ali.
Yeah.
Someone who's completely transformational for the sport in his country, you know, and an icon globally. And that's all we can think about. One incident from a game 30 years ago. I just can't believe it. I think... I know that that is kind of reflective of a certain group within the UK, within England. But I hope it's not reflective of our whole society. I think there's a lot of people in England that really respect Diego Maradona for who he was, you know, as a player.
Yeah, I mean, the election results over the last few years would argue that it's certainly reflective of a majority opinion to be a small-minded little Englander, but...
Well, no, hang on a minute. We might as well talk about elections. You know, what did the Tories get? 44%?
Right, that's true.
So, and there's about 1% for Conservative with a small C parties in Northern Ireland. Everyone else voted for Liberal, you know, Liberal. I know politics, I'm going to get some tweets about this because people are like sick of the football and socialism show. But I actually, you know, just to you know, put numbers on it, right? More than 50% of the country voted for parties with a liberal ideology, small L.
Yeah, no, you're right. That is true. So maybe not a majority opinion, but at least a extremely substantial and extremely vocal minority.
Yes.
This came on the back of...
Anyway, can we talk about Diego
give me one more second on why England's small-minded xenophobia is so rampant and problematic. Matt Law from the Daily Telegraph, the day before, had tweeted when Marcelo Bielsa was shortlisted for Coach of the Year, he tweeted, he's less worthy of the award than Chris Wilder. Okay, well, actually, that one, there's some merit to it. Frank Lampard and Dean Smith, but they don't get a look in because they're English. To quote Stuart Lee, you say you're English these days, they throw you in jail. Like, this is the desperate mentality, the victim mentality of the people who hold all the power is absolutely
insane. I know, and it's been leveraged in a disgusting way, especially in the US, but also in England too, you know? We're going to rail against the elites, say the Oxbridge Burlington Club elites. Anyway, Matt Law, it was so ridiculous, that tweet. I had to call it out. But I paused for a second on calling it out because I thought, is he being ironic? I mean, I just like it's just so ridiculous, that mentality. I'm not even getting into the substance of the argument. The idea that English people and managers can't get any credit it blows my mind. Yeah. Right. Anyway.
Diego Maradona.
I want to talk about Diego.
Yeah, yeah, far away.
I'm a bit tired today because I decided to stay up and watch the Maradona documentary again. I'd seen it before. This is the one that was released late last year, which is just an amazing piece of filmmaking, I think. If you haven't seen it, it's available on Prime and Apple and all four. It might be still scheduled because it's partly funded by Channel 4. But you can get it, right? I thoroughly recommend you watch it. It focuses mainly on his time at Napoli with the context of the World Cups, you know. And it's a non-narrative piece of storytelling. So, you know, it goes back in time now and again to talk about his background in Argentina and his family life and stuff like that. But it's just a fantastic documentary looking into the nuances of this player, you know, the fantastic player, the character, his cocaine addiction, how Napoli used him and abused him, his relationship with the mafia. And it's just a really complex character, but someone who was obviously transformational in terms of his talent.
Yeah, I mean... you know, the debate about, I mean, we love the society, I don't mean we as in us, football discourse now, sports discourse now loves the GOAT conversation so much. And football has had this kind of like absolute peak of this argument because you've got two genuine candidates for it vying back and forth every season, winning Ballon d'Or one after the other, basically. But the thing is, the conversation in any sport is you can't compare across eras, obviously. But when you watch Maradona play, you think, I mean, I know this is the most obvious point in the world, but imagine that guy playing on bowling green pitches where it's a yellow card to like tackle someone from behind, whereas it used to not be a yellow card the first time
you
put a hip high challenge in on him, as Rio said.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously the money was in Italy at that time and United couldn't afford it. I remember there was a discussion at United about buying Robert Prosinecki at one time and United couldn't afford the £4 million fee, right? This is in the early 90s, late 80s, something like that. So, it wasn't in the ball game. United weren't competing for players like that at the time, but wouldn't it have been magical? Just a thought experiment of how magical it would be. But, you know, just just you're right, transport that talent into today's game and he would have an impact like no other. And, you know, he's the comparisons aren't, you know, Ronaldo, Portuguese Ronaldo, so different from Messi in terms of, you know, what they mean. Messi, very different from Maradona, doesn't play in that position. You know, there's no one like Maradona in the game today. No one. Just, you know, the ability to dribble, his pass for the winning goal in the 86 World Cup final, outside of his foot, first time, incredible, you know, defence-splitting pass, won the World Cup. Dragged Argentina, you know, what is widely regarded as a pretty average side to two finals, you know, with his talent alone. Took Napoli, a regional team mocked by the rest of Italy, to two Serie A titles. You know, transformational talent, as I've said a few times. And, you know, I'd love to see a player of that talent in today's game.
The closest things, I guess, we've seen a bit more recently, well, it's a long time ago too now, but the Brazilian Ronaldo and Ronaldinho's two-year peak, you know, but Maradona's sort of like all that with a low centre of gravity. Like he was just absolutely amazing. And I put on Twitter, like, I think it makes me really sad that I hated him so much, because now I love him so much. And now, like, it's really clear that we were the baddies, like, in that game.
Yeah.
As a nine-year-old, I didn't have any sense of nuance about that conversation around the hand of God. I just thought he was a real bad, mean cheat. You know, it's funny to see that Peter Shilton, who was a full-grown man then and is now an old full-grown man, who Maradona described as a thermos head, meaning a really, dim-witted person.
Yes, well, that's correct. Yeah. Yes, good assessment.
Yeah, he wrote a piece for the Mail, a column for the Mail, obviously, saying that, you know, he was a great sportsman, a great player, but no sort of sportsman. I'm like, you're writing a column slagging him off the day he died. What's worse? Like, what is worse? Anyway.
Let it go. I'm not going to sing, but, you know, seriously, get some Frozen. I had to read the piece because I can't stop myself doom scrolling through all parts of my life, but come on. Come on, man. I mean, you're outjumped by someone who's 5'6" or whatever. You know, I think the blame is more on Shilton for that goal. And then to not be able to leave it.
Yeah.
Have some class.
Yeah. No.
The day he died.
Absolutely. But the player was electrically exciting, and there are no better compilations than Maradona compilations. And the Napoli story is unbelievable. Darren Richmond, friend of the show, Darren Richmond, put on Instagram a little clip of the story, which is, I mean, it just really is one of the most goosebumps stories. The banner that was lifted over the cemetery in Napoli saying, yes, you don't know what you missed. It's like, oh my God. just magic.
I mean, but you can imagine it, because like, set it in context. I mean, I don't know, there's not really a modern context, but a city that was downtrodden, poor, southern Italy, kind of mocked by the rest of, you know, maybe Liverpool in the
80s,
right?
Exactly, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, if Liverpool in the 80s had come out of the second division in the 80s and won the league, you know, that was the level it would have been, rather than having kind of been established as a dominant force
yes,
already.
Yeah.
It made me really sad, actually, that he died. I'm not normally particularly emotionally affected by famous people dying, because, you know, people die, right?
People die all the time, right?
But there's something about, and, you know, I'm actually not a big advocate of hedonism. I know a lot of people love Maradona because, like, he really lived his life to the full. And I actually think there's something quite profoundly empty about living your life to the full, in inverted commas, in that way. You know, there is a hollowness at the heart of the hedonistic.
Well, sure, and I think that's clear from that the documentary I mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, this wasn't a happy time for him. You know, doing coke from Sunday to Wednesday, as producer Tom will tell you, is
it's
not a great idea.
Listen, I think the three of us,
we've all been there.
Us need to have an amnesty about chucking around drug histories in this show. Sorry. sorry, listeners. A bunch of images just flashed through my head of this reprobate.
Good times.
But yeah, but you know.
But yes, continue your point.
The thing is, he clearly had that an extraordinarily intense life force. And, you know, as anyone who is idolized at the age that he was and put under the level of scope, like scrutiny and pressure that he was, he's done a lot of damage to people in his life. You know, this is not, you know, this is a person whose personal life is a trail of like...
Oh, no, sure. He was estranged from his son who denied he existed for, you know, 20 years and estranged from his now ex-wife or his ex-wife and his two daughters, you know, it's caused a huge amount of damage to his family and the people closest to him.
But
as addiction can, you know, make
exactly
happen all the time.
But my God, what a player! And my God, the coolest looking football photos you'll ever see: Maradona in a Boca Juniors shirt, like Maradona in that '80s Argentina shirt. Like,
I want one of those.
Real cool.
I've got there's a picture of me, I think you've seen it, when I'm about, what, 4 or 5 with an Argentina 78 shirt, and I've got a big bush of hair. You know, I could have been Maradona.
You could.
I'm the Maradona of the podcasting world.
You said there were certainly periods of your life. No, let's not.
let's not go there.
All right. So I've got to go in 4 minutes. So... Southampton,
difficult for United.
I'm not looking forward
for so many reasons. I mean, Southampton are doing well this season. You know, they're fifth in the table. Hasenhüttl has imprinted his style on them deeply. And it's the style with which United struggle. You know, there was a moment in the Istanbul game where Lindelof hit one over the top and United, you know, beat the press that way. Because they did press at times at Istanbul, not much. And, you know, I wonder whether that might not be a good tactic, because as much as we like to think Lindelof and Maguire are good ball players, honestly, they're not that good.
Yeah,
ball players.
And, they, you know, Lindelof can hit that long pass. And I mean, he came off injured, didn't he, Lindelof, and Twanzebe came on.
So we'll see. Maybe it's Twanzebe. Who has more to his game? You know, the tool set is bigger. Mm. The experience, not so, and the injury record, not so, but... The tool set is bigger, so we'll see. He may well play.
Yeah, I mean, I am very nervous about this one. Very nervous. I mean, I was very nervous about the Istanbul game, and we won that comfortably. I'd be real surprised if we win this one really comfortably. Seems a long shot at this point.
Yeah, and I wonder whether the style might change a little bit and United will invite Southampton to try and attack, because, you know, stylistically, I think that's one of the ways to beat them. And you know, also you've got to stretch them out to beat their press. We'll see. We'll see. I agree, it'll be a tough one. I mean, it's away from home, not that it matters that much right now. The statistics show that home advantage has disappeared. Yeah. So, you know, hey, we'll see. I think it'll be a tough game. If a prediction, I'm going to say 1-1.
Yeah, so they will play 4-4-2, most likely. And
Che Adams has been scoring. Walcott scored in the last
game.
It'll
be them two up front, because Danny Ings is injured and Nathan Redmond is not expected to play in this
game.
Which
is good, because Ings is having another fantastic season.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think United should try and break the press by going over the press rather than necessarily always trying to go through it. And I think if they do, I would love to see the same front three start. I think it'd be I would love to see almost the same.
We'll see how Cavani's fitness is holding up and whether he's fresh.
I mean, it was Tuesday to Sunday, so it's a pretty
a bit of space. I mean, they've got a soft middle. You know, if it's Ward-Prowse and Romeo, I think United can play through that too. Mm. Yeah, we'll see. And the other risk, of course, with Southampton is Ward-Prowse's set pieces, both direct and indirect, are excellent. Yeah. And so it'd be good to not give fouls away around our box. But at the back, they've had problems. You know, Walker-Peters, I don't know that he's been excellent since he joined. There's some talk, there was in the summer, but now again about Brandon Williams maybe going there on loan. We'll see. And Bednarek and Vestergaard playing the last one, I think there's some weakness there for sure. You know, so, you know, our chances of winning are by attacking and working out how to get the ball into the attacking third without losing it and causing ourselves problems.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to predict, for no reason other than being wildly reactive to swings in United's form on the pitch, a 2-1 win in this one.
All right. Well, I think I said 1-1. Yeah. We'll see. I hope you're right.
I mean, I'm talking, that's just literally last week we played badly and then afterwards, oh, we're never going to be good again. Now we played well. I'm like, oh, yeah, we're probably going to win. So, you know, whatever. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll speak to you soon.
Have a great one. Bye now.
But here's Maradona again. He has Burchaga to his left and Valdano to his left. He won't need any of them. Oh, you have to say that's magnificent. There is no debate about that goal. That was just pure football genius.
No question.